storm last week, and sure enough, a day or so later, it usually travels like a million miles an hour, so it takes sometimes sometimes 2 days to actually get here. So they know it's coming by staring at the sun with SOHO and ACE. ACE is another one that they have out there. Discover is another one that they have at the L1 location, staring at the sun. They know something's coming. Know if it's coming in the direction of the Earth. I remember the 1989 incident. That caused power failures throughout Canada. Some problems in the States as well. That was a big magnetic storm. Recently, the K values were I saw 4.5 the other day, 4, which is for this time of year, usually it's a lot lower. But the sun is active; it's getting to be a peak. I think cycle 25 will be a peak toward the end of next year. Is the prediction, Wesley. That's pretty much what I know about it. But if you, I like their website, NOAA. Let me drop it. And when you look at that space weather for NOAA, not only do they give you the K value every of the last 3 hours, they also give you a nice map. And you look at the pole, and you could tell where the aurora is by. They have colors. They have color the aurora in, either green, which is it's active, but not very active. Then they have yellow and of course red, and you can see it rotating around the pole. If every 6 hours or so you look at it, you can see that the main portion of the solar storm is rotated. If it's a real strong solar storm, you can see it goes completely all the way around. Canada and Alaska, to other parts of Russia. Interesting website. Back to net control. Over to you, Roy. WS1.
Thank you, Paul. Wes, you want to continue? There's really not much to say about the differences between devices and biological. Living on the ISS is not a healthy thing. It produces a lot of biological problems. There are visual disturbances, bone thinning, pressure buildup in your brain. We're not really evolved to exist in freefall for months upon months. And so cosmic rays, I'm sure, are not helping anyone either. So the astronauts deal with it as best they can, and after a time, they rotate them off the ISS before it can get worse.
Thank you very much for this explanation. So, yes, it is very much known. It's nothing new about it, creating a field that acts as a magnetic sphere for the space station that could be change the situation to make it on the space station. So the strong magnetic field must be generated by low temperature semi-space superconductors, and they are suitable material to use to generate the strong magnetic field. So those materials could be used in the structure space and are the long duration space travels in the future. It's not new idea. It used to be presented in sci-fi movies. Okay, the next one. For the next one, any question?
V1, hey Jason.
Go ahead.
This is W1HXN. I just wanted to acknowledge break back to net.
W1HXN, recognized. What's your first name, sir?
My name is Brian Bravo Romeo, India Alpha November. I'm located on Cape Cod, and I just wanted to let you know that your signal from your repeater is coming in at my station at plus 20, and just wanted to let you guys know I'm listening to all your conversations and really enjoy the whole thing. So let me send it back in there. This is W1HXN.
Okay, very good, Brian. Glad to have you aboard. I mean, I'm glad the propagation conditions are so good. The repeater has good days and bad days. If you're ever curious about our net, we hold it every Sunday night, starting at 8 o'clock, finishing up around 11. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the net, it's available a bunch of different ways. We are available on Echolink. We have an Echolink node, W2VL-R. We have an internet-based audio stream. You just type into a browser, technet.atcgs.com. And we have an archive of the audio files at a website called amateurradio.tv.
Very good. Very good. I usually talk to George, KD2FIU, and when the propagation is correct, we've got very good signals and so, going back and forth. So anyway, just wanted to chime in and let you know that your signal is doing really, really well, and enjoyed listening to all of your conversations and so forth. Very nice. Send it back to net. This is 71HXN.
Okay, very good, Brian. 73, have a good day, and hopefully we'll talk again down the line. Wesley, I don't think anyone had any questions about the second item. Do you want to go to the third?
Thank you very much, Chris. Okay, so before I start, Lawrence 4th, small Basel, like Basel, combination of electric and magnetic force at a point charge, right, due to the electromagnetic field, that would be probably not full, but partial explanation for Lorentz force. And talking about a point charge, remember some time ago we were talking about line source, point source, and now we have a point charge. So we disregard the word charge. What is the major difference between point charge, point source, and line source?
You asking me, Wesley?
Yeah, that is correct.
Okay, a line source is a two-dimensional object. A point source is a one-dimensional object.
That is correct. The only question was, what is the difference between point charge and the two other line charge, line source and point source? What is the difference, the physical difference between them?
Again, as far as I am concerned, it is the dimensionality. You have things that exist in one dimension, some that exist in two, some that exist in three, and unfortunately, things that exist in four. A line is just a length. It's just that dimension of length. Whereas actually a point source is a zero-dimensional thing. Electrons and such are point sources. They do not probably have any dimension. There's no such thing as how wide is an electron. You can find out how wide an electron is less than because it's less than the length that can be measured with the equipment. Because there's no way to quite measure zero, that's the way that it's registered. But it's the dimensionality that's the difference as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, actually, I was thinking about what a point charge in terms of Lorentz force, what the point charge needs to do in order to feed into the Lorentz force.
I'm not quite sure what you're getting at. I'm sure you're trying to get at something, so you might as well kind of supply the next step yourself.
Okay, I do it. But the thing is that point charge due to electromagnetic fields, in order for the particle to experience the Lorentz force, the charge must be moving. So the particle that the charge Q moving is in with the velocity V is an electric field in the electric field E and magnetic field B. Then, if everything is as it is, then we'll experience the Lorentz force. And we need that Lorentz force for the next object that we're talking about. The major difference between charge particle and photon is that photons do not carry electric charge. So, a question if somebody wants to respond. How photon differ from the charged particle? But the photon must carry something, right? So, what is the major difference between photon and charged particle?
Okay. Photons are the carriers of electromagnetic energy. That's what they are. And they can't in themselves carry a charge because that would make them unable to be the source of the carrier for electromagnetism if they themselves are charged. So it's kind of the same with all the other force carriers. Don't manifest the forces themselves because they have to be the carriers. So photons are the means of carrying electromagnetic energy from one place to another. A charge is a characteristic of a particle, usually a fermion, not a boson, that can be positive or negative. In the case of protons, they're positive. In the case of electrons, they're negative. And there's antimatter. And then quarks have individual charges among themselves that cancel out in the case of neutrons, and that add up in the case of protons. But again, force carriers are different than particles that have characteristics themselves.
Yeah, beautiful. Okay, so because photons cannot carry electric charge, they cannot be straightforwardly controlled using the real magnetic field. They do not experience that. So that's all of the stuff we were talking about was just to make it straight. But there are severe limitations that is dictated by fundamental laws of physics. But physics is trick photon, and they trick it based on not specially loved by Dr. Roy area of waveguides called interface and polaritrons and plasma. The University of X-ray has pioneered in new technique that is to create tunable artificial magnetic fields which enable photons to mimic the dynamic of charged particles in real magnetic fields.
Wesley?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on with the repeater, but you have a lot more noise. When you first came on earlier tonight, you were full quieting. Now you're about 60% noise.
How is it done?
A little bit better. Now it's just kind of 10% noise.
Okay. So, but my previous transition was okay, right?
Well, you've gone back up to about 60% noise, so I'm not quite sure exactly what's going on.
WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, you're getting crappy as well, but not as much as Wesley. Yeah, it's something with the repeater. I'm hearing it both on Glen Oaks and out here in Selden.
Maybe we should have all moved up to Cape Cod for this night.
How am I coming now?
I concur. And he sounded great. Back to you.
Yeah, he did. He sounded great. You sound a little bit better, Wesley, but it's probably subject to change.
I don't think it's going to change. How about now?
It's okay. It's only about 10-15% noise.
Okay, so I'm going to repeat it. University of X-Ray pioneered in new technique, QDBOR special magnetic fields, which enable photons to mimic the dynamics of charged particles in real magnetic fields. So in other words, that's what is impossible for photons to do. They were able to achieve making our photons to behave sort of like charged particles, like electrons. Okay, now, they did it in reviews of the waveguide. But the waveguide, we say two-dimensional waveguide, for us it looks like two-dimensional waveguide, called interface, when we're dealing with polaritons and plasma, which is photons. It's just a different name from the frequency. So they could drastically reconfigure polariton Landau level spectrum by simply changing the cavity width. Now, what they did is they created one atom thick material, graphene. So the same graphene that I started my conversation with, this could be used for clothing. Now what they did is they used this material that is one atom thick, and they put the photons through it. And after that, they were able to actually create a pseudo-magnetic field strength that can be tuned from modifying the surrounding electromagnetic environment via the closing cavity waveguide, which modifies the nature of the dipole or antipole structure.
AC2GS, okay. Basically, what's going on is I'm not really that thrilled with the terminology. As I mentioned earlier, physicists are very bad at naming things and usually confusing everyone. They do not seem to use the word pseudo magnetic field or artificial magnetic field. The word that they've decided to use is synthetic magnetic field. And in the thing that I don't like is it's not a magnetic field. It's an object. It's a piece of metamaterial that interacts with photons in some ways similar to the way that magnetic fields interact with electrons. So they're not really, in my mind, anything like a magnetic field. It's just a piece of metamaterial. Materials are perfectly fine to interact with photons, and so the way the characteristics that it interacts is reminiscent of how electrons interact with magnetic fields. So to kind of muddy the waters by terming them pseudo-magnetic fields, artificial magnetic fields, or even their term synthetic magnetic fields, I tend to find is problematic. It doesn't solve anything, and it introduces a lot of confused people who don't quite know what the heck they're talking about. So this is a story about using a material, graphene-based metamaterial that interacts with photons in curious, interesting ways that are reminiscent of electrons interacting with magnetic fields, but there's no magnetic field in this entire experiment. It's photons and metamaterial interaction.
Well, actually, I forgot to say, the metamaterial that we talked about is thinner than the wavelength. And this is the major major requirement. So we'll be talking about the art of the zero magnetic field. But they specify the dipole-to-dipole interaction owing to the competition between short-range Coulomb interaction and long-range photon-mediated interaction. So they call it zero magnetic field that is switch off, switch on, and the critical target to be or without removing the strain that helps it strength.
One second, let me do a quick little thing. Okay, again, there's some reference material called some tunable pseudo-magnetic field. I have always had problems with physicists using new terms, and sometimes they're appropriate, sometimes they're whimsical, and sometimes they confuse everyone. Almost everyone at one time or another is deeply confused by physicists' choice of naming quantum spin states as mechanical spinning. If you talk to a lot of high school students about anything related to electrons having a quantum spin, they see it as a marble rotating through space. It ain't. Quantum spin has nothing to do with the mechanical nature of spin. Again, it's simply the physicist picking a really bad term for something that led to a lot of confusion among a lot of physics students and otherwise. So, okay, it's an interesting thing that they're able to play with polaritons. I don't know what this is going to lead to. I don't think you know what this will lead to. It may lead to something great. It may never be heard from again. But, okay, so a pseudo-material, a metamaterial, is capable of manifesting magnetic field-like characteristics onto photons. So, you know, I don't know exactly what to do with that.
Well, being able to emulate phenomena with photons that are usually thought exclusive to charged particles will be fascinating from a fundamental point of view. Could also have important implications for the photonics application. Interesting.
Okay, I mean, it's worth a paper, maybe two. But okay, I don't know what to draw a conclusion as far. This is a vaguely interesting concept. It doesn't really impact me personally. I have no real fundamentally improved understanding of the universe based upon this. It's just a clever ploy using metamaterials, and we've talked about metamaterials many times in the past. They're an entire group of materials that have fascinating characteristics, so we bump this one down with the rest on the list. I guess we move on. I mean, I don't think that this is going to impact your or my life personally, but who knows? Well, what do I know?
Yes, you were perfectly right. The last sentence that I said was partially from the text that I memorized. My problem is I wasn't born with English language, so I'm trying to memorize certain codes. So when I repeat it quite a few times, then I'm actually trying, it's easier for me to repeat it instead of just make my own version of it. But anyhow, everybody in cell, then it's not that much important. So it's like using the mechanism that you can take from the best trajectory of polaritons using tunable Lorentz light force and observe Landau quantization of the polarization spectral orbit in the international is what happens to charged particles in magnetic fields, real magnetic fields we have. We can deal with something that actually looks to us like two-dimensional, but it's a highway where the photon can travel, an electromagnetic wave can travel. And that's why we have a certain point at which the electromagnetic wave behaves a certain way we want it.
As you mentioned, it's already 10:35, and certainly time for Paul, WS2N, and the SpaceNet report.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Roy. And if I thought to sound very noisy, let me know, and, you know, we'll just continue on in the future. Not a problem. Nothing really urgent. By the way, the website I was talking about, the NOAA website, it gives the information, especially about the K index, which is very important for radio propagation as well, is the Weather Prediction Center. So you can go to swpc.noaa, that's NOAA.gov, swpc.noaa.gov, the Space Weather Prediction Center. It's a very good site. Let you know, how the, the K index is doing, which gives you a rough idea of radio propagation. So, popular one that I always look at. So, okay, let me go on here with the SpaceNet report. This is WS2N. Stand by. We talked about the International Space Station before. They are going to have a slow scan TV experiment, which is planned for the International Space Station. ARIES is involved with this. That's the amateur radio on the space station. They're in collaboration with the ARRL to put out some slow scan TV. Not going to be very long, in duration, but they are going to do it on this Wednesday, July 26th. They're going to use the repeater on board the Columbus module. International Space Station has at least 16 different modules that people are living in. So the one near the front of the space station is called Columbus, and that's where the amateur radio is located for the European Space Agency as well as for NASA. And they'll be transmitting on 70 centimeters. And they're going to use the repeater on board that module. They have transmitting on 437.800. Now the idea is transmit for a group. It's going to be the Teachers Institute of Wireless Technology. That's really who it's for. Going to be transmitting 16:05 Eastern Standard Time, which roughly 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and only about maybe 15 minutes afterwards, and that's going to be it. So they're looking for amateur radio operators that can copy that, which I don't have that program then, but if you do, you'll be able to copy a message with a picture, and they're really doing it for the teachers. It's in collaboration with that, but naturally, we could all receive the radio signals. And I'm sure there'll be a write up about this, I guess, next week or the week after. WS2N. Okay. Rocket Lab, I've talked about them many, many times. It's a company owned by Peter Beck, and they fly the Electron rocket, and, which they've flown over 30 times, I think around 35 times, successfully since 2017. So they've been at it for a while, and each year they're doing more and more flights. I think this year they're on schedule to probably do an average of one a month, probably 12 flights. This next flight that went up successfully. They launched 7 satellites. 3 of them were for NASA, and they're doing a swarm deal, which is like when they have three or more satellites located roughly in one area, collecting the same information over time. They call that a swarm setup, and it's a NASA. They're testing out new technology on these 3 satellites, trying to improve on the capability of autonomous operations for satellites. You know, eventually, even now they have them in orbit, but more and more so in the future, especially when they go around the moon or different planets, they're going to need to be fully autonomous. So they're testing the technology on these particular swarm satellites. The reason I bring it up is Electron is a rocket that's soon to be reusable. I know I've talked about this before, but they have, on the first stage, they have 9 Rutherford engines. But, you know, they use RP-1 fuel that's refined kerosene and liquid oxygen to fly their rockets. They are powered by, when I say powered, the turbopumps that are run are run by motors. Each one has like a 50 horsepower electric motor, and each one has its own lithium ion batteries that they launch, and they eventually separate some of those batteries. The batteries, when they use up, they get rid of them. They fall away in space, and they switch to another one. That's how they run their pumps. So it's very economical, very lightweight rocket, and it's been very successful. But now they're into reusability. They've tried this a couple of times in the past, where the idea was to have the rocket from flying through the atmosphere. No propulsion, not a propulsion, like SpaceX has. They come through the atmosphere with propulsion all the way down to when they land. This will just fall through the atmosphere here. It's insulated enough where it doesn't burn up. And this first stage booster comes down on a parasail. And the original plan was to grab it with a helicopter, grab the parachute with the helicopter. They tried it 2 times, and it failed, and it just didn't work out. It's too difficult for the pilot and all to do that. So now they decided, well, let's just land it into the ocean, which they're doing, and they sealed off everything with this booster, where salt water can't get into the different components, electronic components, into the plumbing and all. And they successfully did that. They picked it up with a ship that they had out there, and they're going to bring it back, and they're going to try to refurbish at least one engine in the beginning to see if they could refly it. You know, it's a relatively small rocket compared to what SpaceX launches. SpaceX launches with 2.2 million pounds of thrust on the first stage. This thing launches with 55,000 pounds of thrust. You know, if you were to take like just one engine from the 747, put it on the bottom of the rocket, it would be equivalent to what Rocket Lab is doing, and that's their main purpose right now, to be able to get to the point where they could reuse the first stage of the rocket, and not to be outdone. Over time, they plan on eventually having the neutron rocket instead of the electron rocket. The neutron rocket, which would be a large rocket, almost the size of the Falcon 9. You know, they're going to be competitive with SpaceX over time. They're in a, right now they're building a facility in Virginia, and they plan on building the Neutron rocket in Virginia. So hopefully things go well. They have a one launch facility now in the state of Virginia down on Wallops Island, and two launch facilities in New Zealand they launch off the North, they call it the North Island, the two big islands down in New Zealand. So they're doing well. They have one launch complex there, and they built another one. So there are three different places they can launch from. Any questions? WS2N for the SpaceNet report. Okay. Is a topic that Chris brought up, K2STP, which I thought was very interesting. He gave us an update on the DART mission. Yeah, DART mission is the double asteroid redirection test that occurred last September. That's where NASA took this spacecraft and smashed it into a binary asteroid. The idea was to slow down the one asteroid that was the small one that was orbiting the larger one to see if that it could affect the orbit, and it did. They slowed it down. Their goal was, I think, 73 seconds, and they got past that, probably like 100 seconds, slowing down the orbital time that it went around the main asteroid. So it was successful with this 2,000-pound thing that crashed into it. It was running on 6.6 kilowatts, which is quite large. You know, they have a solar panel called ROSA, R-O-S-A, Rollout Solar Array, which is a new technology that NASA's been using. It, you know, instead of these panels that unfold, it just rolls out like a shade. So successful that they're now putting them on the International Space Station to supplement the power on board space station. So the reason Chris brought it up was they used the Hubble Space Telescope to take pictures of this asteroid, this binary asteroid recently, and they could see chunks of rock or rubble that are leaving that asteroid at a slow pace. Some of them are as big as 20 feet in diameter. So the shock that, you know, that was created when the DART hit the asteroid apparently shook some of the stuff loose. And so, you know, that's a credit to the Hubble Space Telescope, that's for sure. But this mission also had another small spacecraft on board that was released right before they crashed, and that had a camera on it at all. It was called LICA, L-I-C-I-A. It was a camera on board, and it took pictures like when it was like 30, 40 feet away from the asteroid. You know, got some pictures, sent it back. I don't remember them talking about boulders coming off of it, but, you know, that gives you an idea of the capability of Hubble, you know, being millions of miles away compared to this one that was, you know, feet away from the asteroid when it was taking pictures. But they're not done with DART yet. In the near future, it should be launched this October, actually, not this October, following October, 2024. The European Space Agency has contracted a flight using the Falcon 9 SpaceX. Launch they call it the Hera mission, H-E-R-A. Hera mission is going to go out to the asteroid that DART crashed into, and it's going to have cameras on it, it has all kinds of magnetometers, you know, a lot of equipment, altimeters, spectrometers. Anyway, they're going to take pictures, close-up pictures of these two asteroids when it gets there. And like I said, it'll be launched in 2024. Sometime, I guess, after that, probably a year or so, they'll start doing that. And they want to go one step further. This Hera mission also has two little tiny CubeSat satellites on board, and they're going to separate and do some more science, and eventually they're going to land them onto the asteroid. And then in the future after that, they're going to take the Hera mission itself and have that thing land on the asteroid. But, you know, before they do that, they're going to make sure they take all kinds of pictures and scientific investigation of this double asteroid system. So Didymos and Dimorphos is not a dead issue. You know, DART was only the beginning. Any comments? This is WS2N. I'd like to thank Chris K2SDP for sending that email. Very good. Got me looking into to the DART mission. I forgot about Hera. I knew that. That was a big topic a while back, but, you know, time goes by and you forget about that. Sure enough, we'll be looking into that in the future. So it's a step in the right direction to eventually change the orbits of asteroids and maybe even comets in the future. This is WS2N. Any comments? Topic I've talked about in the past is they're still going along. This company, Vast, they plan on launching a small space station called Haven 1. They're going to launch it on a Falcon 9 rocket, and Dragon will eventually dock with it, you know, with a crew of four. And, you know, I've talked about this before, where they're going to utilize, you know, both living spaces. Basically what they're doing is increasing the living space of a Dragon capsule. But at the same time, they're also going to be playing around with gravity, artificial gravity. That's the goal of Vast. The goal of Vast is eventually to start having second stage boosters be launched into space and then put them together. They're going to eventually be living quarters. This linear deal, hundreds and hundreds of feet long, eventually 300 or 400 feet long, and then slowly spinning it and then creating artificial gravity. I mean, this company is, you know, I mean, people talk about this all the time. They actually plan on doing something like this. We have a long, long wait. Let's see if they can get Haven 1 into orbit 2024. I think it's 2024. You know, that's there at the earliest, anyway. My guess is going to be after that, probably 2025, tail end of that. All these companies, SpaceX included, they make these predictions, and you find out, you know, yeah, sometimes they come true, but it's a year or two later. SpaceX did that with Falcon Heavy. I remember that. Oh, we're supposed to go 2013. Well, they did it. I mean, it was 5 years later, 2018, but they're usually wildly optimistic with their predictions. Any comments? WS2.
Good evening.
Hey. You know, a topic we used to talk about a lot, since Dick used to bring it up all the time, K2RAW, was the Voyager. He loved to talk about how Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 were doing. So I haven't given up an update on that in quite a while. If he was around, we'd be giving an update on it like once a month. But, Voyager 1 is still out there, just past the 160 AU mark. From the sun to 93 million miles. So, you know, you multiply that distance times 160, and that's where Voyager is now, you know, three and a half times the distance to Pluto, where Voyager 1 is, and Voyager 2 is doing the same thing. That's not as far. It's 130. It's only 133 AU. Anyway, it's still communicating with Earth after launching in September of 1977, and they're actually doing well. When they transmit to, you know, to give Voyager 1, let's say, take 22 hours. 22 hours just to get there. Another 22 hours to get back. It's almost 2 days now, you know. You transmit on a Monday, it's going to be like, you know, someday in the near future. We got to wait around for Wednesday to find out if the message we sent and told Voyager 1 to do something, whether it's amazing, really amazing. Any comments? Okay. Amazon, which is run by Jeff Bezos, they're building a manufacturing building in Florida. It's in the grounds of, you know, the Kennedy Space Center. You know, I think it's called the Exploration Park. And, you know, they're well on the way to building an almost, probably a completed building already with, you know, for the building of their soon-to-be New Glenn rocket that they plan on launching within a year or so. And that's big. I mean, that's like the Starship type of thing. It's that SpaceX has. It's in the Apollo category, Apollo 5 category. And that's one big building. That building. Now they just broke ground on another building, and they plan on manufacturing satellites there. What kind of satellites? They're going to be putting up these communication satellites similar to what SpaceX has with their Starlink program. These are Kuiper satellites going to be built. Their goal is to launch, get this, another 3,200 satellites. That's what Amazon plans on doing. And, you know, they've contracted, I think, 30-some-odd launches with the new Vulcan rocket that hasn't even flown yet that Lockheed and Boeing are building. Another, who knows how many launches with their own new Glenn that they plan on eventually getting operational within a year or so. They've also hired a European Space Agency to do this as well. They plan on doing the same thing with them, using the new Vulcan, not Vulcan, the new Ariane 6 rocket from European Space Agency.
That time, completely.
So thousands of more satellites from Amazon. Who knows how many more thousands more from SpaceX. China plans on doing the same thing. There's going to be more satellites around Earth. It's going to be a wonder that, you know, we're going to be able to make it to the moon. You have to make it through all these satellites just to get out of Earth orbit. Anyway, coming to an end. I think I'll close down. We'll turn it back to you. Been WS2N Paul for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. We should be on tomorrow night. Club is always, club meeting is always 8:30 on these repeaters. Back to you, Roy, AC2GS, WS2N.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do for the technical net. Thank you for all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it, and I especially appreciate it, so thanks. This is AC2GS. Our rebels now are done, fellows. As always, I want to remind you a couple of quotes. Dick, we'd end this TechNet with be kind to each other, so please keep that in mind. Always like to mention good old Epictetus. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows, so try and keep your mind open. And try and learn something new every day. Just keep the brain a little bit younger. If you don't use it, you lose it, type of thing. So please exercise your brain. Thanks to everyone who participated tonight. You guys make or break any kind of a technical mess, so I do appreciate it. I hope you will join us again next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do it all over again. So have a safe week. Have fun. Enjoy yourself. It's summer. And please come back and join us. This is AC2GS formally closing this episode of the Limelight Technical Net. And I am clear after I say Slava Ukraine. Till next week, guys. Stay safe.
Thanks, Roy.
Brian Paul, K2SDP, clear.
Yeah, Chris. Have a good night. We'll catch you next week. Further down the log, as they say.
W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
Good morning. The time is 1:55 a.m. Partly cloudy. Temperature 74 degrees.
W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Good morning. The time is 4:55 a.m. Partly cloudy. Temperature 70 degrees.
This is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 o'clock a.m.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Good morning. The time is 5:01 a.m. Partly cloudy. Temperature 70 degrees.
W2VL repeater.
Whiskey Bravo 2, Mike Sierra Bravo, mobile listening.
Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
Good morning. The time is a.m. Partly cloudy. Temperature 69 degrees.
W2VL repeater.
Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Good morning. The time is 7 a.m. Mostly cloudy. Temperature 71 degrees.
Mobile.
W2VL repeater.